In the coming week, Belarus faces global condemnation after its airline diversion. West Africa braces for the fallout of Mali's coup within a coup, and the U.S. marks Memorial Day in 100 years since the Tulsa race massacre. It's May 27, 2021, and time for The World Next Week. I'm Bob McMahon.
And I'm Jim Lindsay.
Well, Jim, we're going to kick off by looking back a few days at something that's now playing out quite visibly across the European continent, which is controversy over moves by Belarus, specifically involving the diversion or what some are calling a skyjacking of a passenger jet. It was a Ryanair flight, was supposed to be en route from Athens to Vilnius, and was forced to land in Minsk after Belarusian officials claimed the flight was under a bomb threat. When it landed in Minsk, a opposition journalist was removed from the flight along with his girlfriend. Since then, again, there's been a lot of scorn. There's been a great diversion of flight, seemingly, over Belarus. But can you catch us up to speed, Jim, on what we're seeing play out in this incident and what maybe some of the broader implications are?
Yes, Bob. The reaction we're seeing around the world depends upon which capital you're in. In some capitals, there has been real outrage over what people are calling a state-sponsored hijacking or air piracy. In other capitals, are quiet or even expressing support for Belarus. So let's begin with those countries that are outraged. Six UN Security Council members, including the United Kingdom and the United States, condemned the forced landing, calling it a blatant attack on international civilian aviation safety and European security. A note that President Biden called the forced landing a direct affront to international norms. And I think it's safe to say that in the European Union, we've heard nothing but condemnation. However, if you go elsewhere, you either hear very little. Beijing's not making much of what happened. And in Moscow, you're seeing something that borders on support. Russian officials said that the actions taken by Belarus were in line with international standards. As best I can tell, President Putin hasn't come out with a full-throated defense. He may be waiting to see how the situation develops and what kind of sanctions the Europeans are going to impose. So far, we have seen the Europeans move to sanction Belarus and to either urge or direct their state airline carriers to avoid flying through Belarusian airspace. I think the bigger question is whether the European Union, either acting alone or in concert with like-minded countries like the United States, like the United Kingdom, impose much more significant costs on Belarus. At this point, much of the focus has been on limiting air flights to Belarus, and the consequences of that, quite honestly, are not significant. If you're Belarusian, you can still fly from Minsk to Moscow. So in some sense, the inconvenience is merely about an hour and a half of extra flight time and a change of airplanes. Likewise, for people who were flying routes that normally would fly over Belarus now have a little bit of time tacked onto their flight, but it's not clear that that's going to dissuade Mr. Lukashenko from the steps that he's taken.
Jim, are we seeing any moves by Belarusian authorities or their Russian supporters to kind of fess up and acknowledge this is about, you know, seizing someone who the state sees as a threat, as opposed to a due diligence in the face of a clear threat to the overall flight, you know, this notion that there was a bomb. We should note that Hamas has denied any involvement in a bomb threat. At one point, some reports were that the threat came from the direction of Switzerland. It just seems like the initial reason seems to not really carry much water, and that all who are watching this closely are noting this is an authoritarian state trying to preserve its prerogative to seize someone they see as a threat.
The talk of a bomb threat from Hamas was a ruse from the get-go. No one believes that was the case. This was clearly an effort by Mr. Lukashenko to force the plane to land so that they could remove an opposition journalist, Roman Protasevich, from the plane. Now, of course, Lukashenko has described Protasevich as a terrorist and has argued that the forced landing was an appropriate measure taken to protect Belarus's security. But I think it's clear that this was done to try to silence a critic, a very popular critic of Lukashenko's regime. Protasevich is the founder of a Telegram messenger app called the Next to Channel, which has several million subscribers and is followed by many people in Belarus as a way to get honest news. And Protasevich helped organize anti-Lukashenko protests over the summer. He's been living in Lithuania since 2019. Of course, while he's a dissident, again, the Belarusian authorities regard him as a terrorist. And I will note that the Belarusian authorities have since released video of Protasevich saying that he was treated with maximum correctness. I believe that was a phrase they interviews and confessing to criminal charges. I will also note that Protasevich in that video showed the evidence of having been beaten. He was bruised about the face. His girlfriend, who was on the flight with him, was a law student, was also charged with a criminal offense, and she appeared in a similar confessional video.
Clearly, it's Belarus continuing this crackdown. By the way, we should note Russia has mounted a pretty severe crackdown of its own against dissidents, people who support Alexei Navalny, and so on. Basically, supporting this line that at the end of the day, the state is going to do what it needs to do to protect itself against what it sees as threats. But it does, once again, pose this challenge to the EU. Many have noted the EU acted fairly quickly to condemn and then take steps to cut off flights to Belarus. There's serious talk, as you noted, of sanctions. It's a question of how far they're willing to go to both, you know, make a clear gesture against what happened with an airline flight that was bound for an EU nation and what it means for pro-democracy forces, which are already sort of embattled across the continent.
Well, I would expand the consequences beyond that, Bob. I think this sets a terrible precedent for the whole broader issue of global governance. Here is a country clearly violating the rules of international flight. And I will note that the International Civil Aviation Organization, which is an arm of the United Nations, is holding an emergency meeting today to discuss this. And it creates a real problem because if Belarus is not punished for this, you're likely to see this precedent repeated in the future. And you're going to be seeing another area in which sort of the rules-based order, we can use that phrase, is being further frayed. And it's odd because, you know, we've had really tremendous cooperation in a lot of so-called technical areas of global interaction, international civil aviation being one, such things as delivering mail and the rest as well. And we never really sort of think about these when we think about international relations, but they have been so successful that we don't even remark about the fact that you can get on a plane, it'll fly over Iran, or it'll fly over Russia, or it'll fly over China, and you're giving no thought to the fact that the country down below may force your plane to land. And I think that confidence has been shattered. And the question is, where do we go from here? If you don't see a full court press against Belarus for this, then I suspect that this will not be a one-off, that we will see incidents like that in the future.
Yeah, I think that's, you've seized on really the bigger case here, Jim. And again, it's not just a challenge for the EU. It is the sort of community of nations that have benefited from these norms. And what are they willing to do to kind of press it forward? A country like Belarus shouldn't be able to get away with this. But at the same time, given what you said about the justifications offered on its behalf and so forth, it seems like it's going to be hard in the international bodies to kind of act forcefully here. But we'll have to see.
You're quite right, Bob. And this comes down to a problem we see over and over again in international relations. When countries break rules, break norms, other countries may try to punish them, but the target country is more than willing to absorb the punishment. I think that's clearly the case in Belarus. Lukashenko is trying to hold on to power. He's really unpopular. We've talked about that over the last 6 or 8 months since the elections last summer. So he's willing to pay a very high price to remain in power. Having said that, Bob, let's turn our attention to West Africa and talk about what's being called a coup within a coup in the country of Mali. In the last week, Mali's president and prime minister were ousted by the officer who led last year's coup and became vice president of Mali's interim government. This is a tense situation in Mali. But first, Bob, can you give us background on this? How did we get to this point?
Yeah, I should first note, Jim, there's a little bit more of an update, which was that we've just had in the last 24 hours the resignation of the interim president and prime minister of Mali a couple days after they were arrested by the military at the behest of the vice president, Colonel Assimi Goïta. Now, this is a country that has been sort of in a state of recurring turmoil since at least 2012. It was dealing with an uprising from Tuareg militias at that time. Since then, various other sorts of armed groups have been running rampant. Those, especially some that have been affiliated with Al-Qaeda as well as the Islamic State. You have two large international contingencies in the country, the United Nations, sort of say, peace maintenance mission, shall we say, and a French mission as well, together totaling more than 20,000 forces, with organizations like this West African regional grouping, ECOWAS, and the UN Security Council trying to press Malian authorities to carry through with what they had planned to do, which was a transition, a peaceful transition transition of power involving civilians at the leadership controls. Now, what triggered this latest incident, Jim, was that Mr. Goita, Colonel Goita, had said that the transition of or the naming of some new cabinet members had occurred without proper consultations, and that he said was in violation of the agreement that had been set in place to carry forth the political transition. Now, the country's in the middle of what's supposed to be an 18-month transition before new elections are held. So why is this important? Well, first of all, this transition is crucial to the country getting on some sort of stable footing to carry out a whole host of reforms. But as I indicated earlier, Jim, it is also seen as necessary to establish some sort of footing to counter ongoing armed groups, not only in Mali, but it's really been a sort of a spreading crisis in this part of Africa, with armed groups mounting increasing numbers of attacks, with real concerns about instability. And you have in Mali, one of the largest countries in West Africa, borders on 7 states. And if we hit a period of crisis and of a weakening of already tenuous sort of central government control, you could have a real problem spilling out within Mali and into the region as well.
Bob, do we understand why Mali has been so vulnerable to the rise of Islamic extremism? I'll note that it's a country of about 20 million people. That population is overwhelmingly Muslim. However, it's ethnically divided. I think there's something like 5 ethnic groups that constitute at least 10% of the population. No group is a majority. It's a poor country. It's also a very young country. I think the median age in Mali is something like 16 years of age. Compare that to the United States, where it's 38. So can you sort of walk us through why Mali is experiencing such deep problems?
Sure, Jim. I mean, Mali is actually one of several countries encountering some of these similar problems. But again, by virtue of its size, by virtue of its proximity to Libya, which is, you know, the country that itself is dealing with an ongoing civil conflict and which had been awash in weapons and had sort of exported extremism as well since the ouster of Muammar Gaddafi about 10 years ago. Mali is one of the countries suffering the spillover. It was primed to be exploited in some ways, given its weaknesses. There is drug trafficking in the area. There is smuggling of migrants. There is kidnapping, all of which are raising income for crime syndicates. And it's Mali. It's Niger, one of the poorest countries on the planet. It's Burkina Faso, which has had one of the largest population movements in the last several years. And all of these things are coming together in a country that has been loosely governed. And as I said, it lurching from one set of turmoils to another since 2012. And so it found in the resentments of certain pockets of the population, whether it was Tuareg rebels or whether it was other ethnic groups, people feeling disenfranchised, people upset at corruption. We should note that there was cheering last summer when there was a coup and the previous government was ousted, because that government had been seen as so corrupt and had seen as basically turning against the population. But at the same time, you had Malians expressing a clear desire not to have military leadership at the controls. Now, you have countries like Chad, which has seemed to be going from one military rule to another. It just lost its longtime military ruler, but seems to be heading for another, series of military leaderships there. The military is sort of asserting its right to be the only lever to provide security, at least in an interim way. In Africa, interim military rule tends to last for quite a long time, or you get the cult of leadership problem that has occurred in other sub-Saharan African countries. But again, back to Mali's problems, it's a problem of geography, its endemic weaknesses, and that it's had this governance crisis and now a leadership crisis that has, I think, it's really focused attention of international bodies, especially the UN Security Council, which is poised to renew the peacekeeping mission there. And it is trying to assert a bit of leverage there. It has come out with some strong statements this past week about the need to observe, norms and to observe the transition agreement that the country was supposed to be following since last fall.
And I'll just note on the issue of Mali's size that it is about 20% larger than the state of Alaska and twice the size of France. Give you some perspective of how big Mali is.
Yeah, and we should note that it has had its periods of real trauma caused by Islamist rebels in particular. And again, raising such concerns that you have France, which still has an outsized role in the region, creating a quite large military unit there to try to keep order and also supporting the UN process. I think the UN peacekeeping mission is close to 17,000 people at this point, Jim. And there is a great deal of concern of what it means to Mali itself, but again, also the region, the spillover effect, and the ability of groups like ECOWAS, this Western African group, to kind of take matters into their own hands and support a peaceful transition. And it's a real painstaking process, and Mali is posing another test.
It sounds like Mali faces very tough times.
With an international agenda already crowded with so many other things, Jim, the fear is that it flies too far far under the radar to get the attention it needs. But Jim, I want to bring things back to the United States and look ahead to the annual Memorial Day holiday. Americans going to mark the holiday this year with a bit more of a bounce in their step, collectively speaking, since last year. Because at this point in the pandemic, you have, I think, by latest count, at least half of U.S. adults have been fully vaccinated. You see signs all over the place about travel resuming, about certain activities picking up. You're going to see a country in a much more celebratory mood. So can you talk a little bit about what Memorial Day this year will mean for the U.S., Jim?
Certainly, Bob. Well, I think for most Americans, Memorial Day means the start of summer, beaches, barbecue, and beer. I think it's especially so this Memorial Day for the reasons you pointed out. It looks like we are undergoing a pandemic reopening. People are eager to get back out and to resume something approaching a more normal life. Vaccines appear to be making that happen. I think also in the good portion of the country, you're going to have good weather. I look at the news reports that typically come out this time of year, something like 37 million Americans are expected to travel 50 or more miles from home over Memorial Day weekend. Bulk of them are going to drive, but something like 2.5 million are set to fly. But the real purpose of Memorial Day, Bob, isn't to attend a cookout, but rather to honor the soldiers, sailors, airmen, airwomen, and Marines who have given their lives defending the United States. The holiday dates back to the months immediately following the Civil War, when several towns and cities began honoring their dead. The holiday was renamed Memorial Day after World War I. And its purpose became to honor all Americans who've died fighting the nation's wars. And this year, it comes at a time in which it looks as if the so-called forever wars are coming to an end. The United States, as we've discussed, is in the process of withdrawing from Afghanistan. And as you look back over the last two decades, something on the order of 4,500 American troops were killed in Iraq, something on the order of 2,300 died in Afghanistan. When you hear statistics like these and the 59,000 troops who died in Vietnam, the 37,000 that died in Korea, the 400,000 that died in World War II, they, like all statistics, can blend and blur together. But each of those people who gave their lives for the country was someone's son or daughter, sister or brother, mother or father. Now, as you know, Bob, on my blog, The Water's Edge, each year I profile on Memorial Day U.S. military personnel who were awarded the Medal of Honor while giving their lives for the United States. And I do it as a way of trying to put a face on these statistics. And if you'll indulge me, I want to tell you the story of one such American right now, and it's Private First Class Robert H. Jenkins. He was born on June 1st, 1948, in a small town in North Central Florida. He graduated from an all-black high school, joined the Marines, and 5 months later was deployed to Vietnam. On March 5th, 1969, Private First Class Jenkins was part of a 12-person reconnaissance team that was defending an outpost just south of the demilitarized zone. Jenkins and another Marine were firing on the attacking North Vietnamese troops when a hand grenade landed near them. Jenkins pushed his comrade to the ground and threw his body on top of him. He saved his comrade's life but lost his own. He would have turned 73 next Tuesday. And if you're in Washington, D.C., and you get to visit the Vietnam Veterans Memorial, you can find his name engraved on panel 30W, line 46. If you ever visit Palatka, Florida, you can see Robert H. Jenkins Junior Middle School, which is named in his honor. So as people down their burgers, beers, and brats over the weekend, I hope everyone takes time to remember men and women like Private First Class Robert H. Jenkins, who gave their lives for the United States.
Jim, I appreciate that. And especially given that, as has often been said, you know, one life is, as the saying went, is a tragedy. A million seems more like a statistic. There are many numbers and statistics that are sort of referenced at this time of year. But when you get into the individual lives involved and what was involved in their sacrifice and their family sacrifices, it really makes it more meaningful. As you say, Washington in particular is a great place to note this. It's something, as someone who's lived in this area now for almost 15 years, it is something really impressive to see how many people come to Washington, whether it's you hear the Rolling Thunder motorcycle group, usually of Vietnam vets, or you see other veterans groups. The monuments are a very impressive way to take this all in, whether it's the Vietnam monument, as we discussed last week, the Korean monument, obviously one of the newer ones, the World War II, but really so many other places that trace that sacrifice. So I appreciate that.
Well, I will just note, Bob, that most American cities and towns have memorials to honor the men and women from those cities and towns who died in the service of their country. And I think we tend to walk by those monuments and never notice them. But I think certainly on Memorial Day, it is a time to sort of think about those people whose names are engraved on those statues and memorials and whose sacrifice is honored there. But I know, Bob, that there's another big commemoration that is set to take place next week that you wanted to talk about, and that's the Tulsa Race Massacre. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about that.
So it just so happens May 31st is also the 100th anniversary of what has been called one of the worst incidents of racial violence in American history. And an incident, by the way, that was very little known, including to myself, until just the last few years, partly through suppression of the incident through many decades. But what will be commemorated on Monday is, as you noted, the Tulsa Race Massacre. This is going back to 1921 in Tulsa, where you had, like you had in many places in the South, what was so-called the Jim Crow separation of Black communities and white communities. Tulsa, though, happened to have one of the most affluent, thriving Black communities, really, in the country. It was known as the Greenwood District. And there was an incident that set it off, and it quickly erupted into a massive attack by white Tulsans against this community. At the end of the day, according to the most authoritative accounts, there were about 300 Black Tulsans were killed. There were more than 1,100 houses were destroyed. Many of them burned down. 10,000 Black residents were basically displaced. You had, as part of what happened in this rampage, you even had planes flying over, dropping bombs of kerosene or turpentine. There's different reports about how that happened. And there was eventually a National Guard forces from outside the area brought in to keep peace, but it was all too late. And there were very little by way of reparation then or now done to respond to this. There are a great many reports now. It gets a very large treatment in the latest National Geographic. Many other national publications are paying more attention to it. It's stunning to see what actually happened and then what didn't happen in terms of any kind of response against it. But it has been doubly resonant, especially last year after the George Floyd killing, the hands of police in Minneapolis, and many other incidents involving police actions against Black Americans. It's a resonant moment, and I think you're going to hear a lot more about this. You're going to see this type of thing coming up in terms of the country's own narrative about its treatment of Blacks. President Biden is going to travel to Tulsa to commemorate it. There's going to be major events taking place next week as part of this commemoration. And again, it's just the fact of knowing about it is the starting point, I think, for many Americans, Jim. And then, you know, what comes next? What kind of conversations should this country be having about that kind of incident and what could be done to both make sure it never happens again, but also, you know, mark what happened and provide some sort of redress?
Bob, why didn't the federal government react to what happened? I mean, it was horrific. The death toll was huge. You talk about planes being used to drop essentially incendiary bombs on Tulsa's Black Wall Street, and the federal government did nothing. Why?
Yeah, I think that's one of the aspects of this that is going to get increasing scrutiny and attention. As I mentioned at the outset, this time period, you still had what were known as the Jim Crow laws in a number of states in the South, and some in as far west as Oklahoma, Jim. And that meant that Blacks lived a separate life, that they were segregated, that they were second-class individuals. And it should be noted, there are a number of people who were putting up a fight initially from the Black community in Tulsa were World War I veterans. And you had some of these incidents happening against Black veterans returning from World War II as well. It's sort of the enduring shame of the country that this was allowed to happen. Again, there was suppression of the actual results once, you know, the devastation was clear and people were moved out and the wreckage was cleaned up. Then there was a great effort by especially state authorities, but there had to have been some complicity at the federal level to allow this to happen. You also had in this country, as has been discussed again and again, especially since last summer, Jim, you know, you've had the rewriting of the narrative of the American South as well, and the erection of, you know, Confederate statues and memorials and so forth. So I think it's part of that broader narrative of the country, Jim, and it's obviously 100 years is a ripe time to kind of bring this up again. And I hope it does lead to a bigger, broader conversation about this and other such incidents, maybe not as sweeping as this, but still as damaging to Black communities in the country.
I think it's a very important point, Bob. The Tulsa Race Massacre stands out for the size of the death toll, but it was hardly an exception. People can go online and Google the term, and you will get lists that run on and on in terms of just horrific things done to African Americans, but also to other people of color. And a lot of those incidents have been suppressed, not talking about, forgotten about, sort of shoved down the memory hole, if I can put it in that phrasing. And I'm actually glad to see it being recognized now, because obviously the country does have to grapple with its history. This cannot be sort of pushed aside. It is a part of who we were as a people. And I think the important thing is for us to become better people to sort of fulfill the promises and visions laid forth in the Declaration of Independence. We haven't achieved that yet, but the struggle continues.
And I would just add to that, Jim, even more more important or as important it is for the U.S. ability to turn around and to press other countries to come to terms with, you know, dark moments of their past, whether it was genocide or attacks on minorities or whatever. The country does this all the time. It does it through State Department reports. It does it through recognitions of genocide and so forth. To this very day, the U.S. is pressing China on its treatment of Uyghurs in Xinjiang. All of that rings kind of hollow if these countries turn around and point to what the U.S. did or did not do on its own soil. And so this is something we're going to see resonating again and again. For Chinese officials say this to the U.S. about the Black Lives Matter movement. And without acknowledging it, without having a transparent discussion, the U.S. is on kind of thin ground.
Certainly, Bob. And I think that things like the surge in racist attacks on Asian Americans, the sudden rise in anti-Semitic attacks in the United States in the last few weeks are all troubling and do have foreign policy consequences, because America's critics, and there are many, love to seize on this to justify their own suppression of dissident and minority voices.
I would just add one more thing. It's not an easy thing, but it's a necessary thing. I happen to live in Germany, in Munich, at a time when they were still going through wrenching discussions 50, 60 years after they were commemorating the rise of Nazism in Munich. And they had a first ever major museum exhibit on that issue when I was there. It was there was some raw emotions on display, but it was also commendable that the Germans were having these discussions and that they were willing to face up to them and kind of lay out what happened and who was complicit and why it happened. And I think healthy societies do that.
Agreed, Bob. Now it's time for us to turn to our audience figure of the week, which listeners can vote on or tweet us at CFR_org. This week, our audience selected 23 billion F-35 sale to UAE. Why is an arms sale to the Emirates in the news, Bob?
Well, Jim, this has been in the news for several months now. This is a deal that people will recall the Trump administration brokered and the Biden administration was following through on, although it was raising concerns in a number of areas. I think the reason it has risen to noteworthiness this week is as a Wall Street Journal report that's being picked up in a lot of places, in which U.S. officials said they have tracked some transport flights between Chinese People's Liberation Army planes landing at an airport in the UAE. And that caused is concerned that the UAE could allow China to access the latest technology that these F-35 fighters, these are the elite top-of-the-line fighters, possess. Now, it should be noted that this sale, as it's scheduled to go through, I believe that the delivery doesn't take place until something like 2027. But there is concern that already China is looking to set up connections, even some sort of basing operation in the UAE that would give it an advantageous position as UAE takes possession of these very elite aircraft. One of the things that's been happening, and I think even before this Wall Street Journal report, is that the Biden administration is looking for some guarantees from the United Arab Emirates that it would not allow any other nations access to technology if the sale goes through. The sale, it should be noted, went through as the UAE agreed to normalize relations with Israel. So there's several things that are on the table now as negotiations continue between Washington and the Emirates. It is seeking the Emirates to provide assurances that Israel's military edge will not be eroded by the taking on of these 50 F-35 fighters. By the way, there's also some Reaper drones and other munitions part of this deal. But also that, as mentioned, that the Emirates does not transfer any new technologies to China or other third parties, and that the new weapons will be limited in any ongoing conflicts in Libya and Yemen, which UAE has been involved with as well. Those are some serious qualifiers, Jim, and it'll be interesting to see what sort of response comes out of the UAE. I'll note that I have not seen yet any kind of formal reaction to the Wall Street Journal report refuting it or affirming it.
Bob, do we have a sense of why Abu Dhabi is increasing ties to Beijing? I mean, it seems surprising given that the United States in many ways is the UAE's security guarantor, and getting closer to Beijing would seem to put that tie in question, as we've seen by the reaction on Capitol Hill to the Wall Street Journal report.
Yeah, I think that's another reason why this report raised so many eyebrows. We are seeing in the Middle East, as in elsewhere in the world, China trying to expand its net of operations, its ability to have some basing. We've seen this parts of Africa as well. And it has been active. It is, you know, if it's playing a roulette wheel, it's putting its bid down on all the numbers on the roulette wheel to try to continue to maintain influence around the world. What does that mean in terms of ties with UAE and why UAE might tilt in China's directions? I don't know, Jim. It is interesting. China does have a lot lot of influence to throw around. Obviously, its aggressive Belt and Road Initiative, you know, has expanded its influence and has been attractive to countries badly in need of infrastructure. Maybe there's some sort of infrastructure involved on the UAE end, that's as well as some sort of military connection. But it does beg the question that you asked, Jim, about what does this mean for the future of UAE-US security ties?
It obviously raises questions about whether the UAE has come to doubt the reliability of the United States and its security guarantee, so that the UAE is hedging its bets. Another possible interpretation, I imagine, is that the UAE is increasing its talks and interactions with Beijing in part to get Washington's attention to say, hey, if you don't pay attention to us, we can court someone else and perhaps get the United States and the Biden administration to be more attentive to its concerns. I'm not sure which, if either of those dynamics is at play, but I think it's going to be very interesting to watch. And I would particularly watch what the reaction is and continues to be on Capitol Hill. I think Congress is likely to be both more concerned, or perhaps more accurate, less inhibited about criticizing what they see as the UAE developing its relations with China.
Yeah, and I think there was already some concern even under the Trump administration about selling sensitive, sophisticated military equipment to the UAE from members of both parties on the Hill. So you're right, Jim, it's going to be worth seeing the Capitol Hill reaction. And that's our look at the world next week. Here are some other stories to keep an eye on. Israel's Knesset votes for a new president. Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison visits New Zealand. And South Korea hosts the P4G summit, its first major climate meeting.
Please subscribe to The World Next Week on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, and leave us a review while you're at it. They help us get noticed and improve the show. Please note that opinions expressed in The World Next Week are solely those of the hosts or our guests, not a CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's program was produced by Zoe Collis with senior producer Jeremy Shirley. Zoe also did double duty as our recording engineer. Thank you, Zoe. Special thanks go out to Anna Shortridge for her assistance. Our theme music is provided by Miguel Guerrero in licensed under Creative Commons. This is Jim Lindsay saying goodbye.
And this is Bob McMahon saying so long and stay healthy out there.